another 2 weeks, another episode. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Nkwa Sonya, and I am back in my bag again. Thanks for tuning in on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Anchor. Joining me today, we go way, 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 way back. Classmate from high school. We reconnected because Facebook can both be your internet overlord and also bring distant friends together and make them closer all at the same time. We got a chance to link up, get back into friendship, and most importantly, I learned that she's a very smart person who's impacting a lot of people and a lot of great, great kids, even can do a mini Vogue on the regular. The one and only, I call her Livy, you know her as Ms. R, also known as Miss Olivia Roach. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Now, of course. I know this is all audio, but you're all purpled out.
All purple. I just got my nails done and they purple.
Just embracing that whole free yes. Black woman vibe. It's so, so important in this day and age. First, I want to hear from you because education is a big part of who you are. And I want to know from you before we get into sort of the headliners. How did this even happen? In terms of just diving into education and figuring out that it's at least what you wanted to do?
I don't know. I feel like all my life I sort of knew that I wanted to teach. But I like jumped around from like, I want to be a detective until I learned that you need to be a cop and like, not. I wanted to be a fashion designer, even though I can't really draw. I wanted to... I don't know. So that was like when I was younger and I'd make comments in high school like, oh, I want to be the teacher that wears like pencil skirts and heels.
Oh, wow.
And I want to be the teacher where like kids get to call me by my first name. But those were all comments that I made before I like knew that I wanted to teach. Mm-hmm. And then in high school, I think I settled in on wanting to go into like psychology and I wanted to go into like mental health counseling, started some stuff and realized I enjoy it. I enjoy learning about these stuff, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. And it wasn't until I graduated from Queensboro in 2013, that I was like, no, teaching is the thing that I need to do. So after I got into John Jay, I applied for a bunch of teaching programs, and the rest is his story.
Including becoming a moderator at a panel with someone whose name I'm blanking on.
Django
Yay
Paris.
For preparation.
Is it Django Paris?
Yes, it is.
Yes, that's my favorite educational activist man. Besides Chris Emden and, yeah. But, yeah, so getting into education as well as activism, they really go hand in hand for me. My job as a teacher is not just to teach my kids English, it's also to advocate for them and teach them how to become advocates for themselves. And in that, like they're reading things that don't represent them, they're learning things and they don't see themselves in it. So naturally, as their advocate, I have to be a part of that advocacy.
Now, why do you think that not so many people see teaching and activism in the same realm? Because when I think activist, primarily thinking you're marching the streets, you're sticking it to the man, all those sort of things. But how does education as a tool, not necessarily as, oh, my activism is educating people, but as a tool, how does education form what you're going for?
Well, if you look at the history of formal education in the world, but also in this country, it's really been like, we're teaching you these things because one, you need to know how to read, how to write, how to do basic math. But then also we're teaching you how to think, what to think, how to go through from kindergarten to 12th grade. And a lot of that is created by agents of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. So if we have people that are in the school system that are not white people, even though also white supremacy is detrimental to white people as well, but we have black and brown kids, we have Native American kids who are going through this system and it's harming them. And so as much as people are like, oh, activism in the streets, you're marching, you're standing in front of Congress, you're doing all of that. Doing all of that is fine, but we can't leave out all the other spaces that white supremacy touches. So people will march and like that's their thing. People will go speak in front of Congress and go speak in front of panels and whatnot. But for me, it has to be in the classroom because the kids that I'm educating, they are a part of our future. yeah.
And let's talk about the kids for a second, because I'm sort of learning that this generation of kids is different, I think, for one principal reason. You can't really shelter them from anything.
No.
They know everything.
They know things.
If you were 8 years old when Trayvon was shot and George Zimmerman got off, you probably had a phone where you saw these things, or whether you watched your mom watch something, you probably saw a bunch of tweets about it. For this particular generation, how do you backtrack the effects of white supremacy? Or is it something that can even be tackled?
Well, I think the thing about this generation, like as you said, like you can't shelter them from information because they have the internet at their fingertips, like on their phones. And I think one of the things that we need to do is to show them how they can use this mini computer that they all have to help learn things as well as raise awareness. Because it's so powerful. Like a lot of my kids have so many followers on Instagram. They have, a few of them have like YouTube pages where they're doing videos. So they have a wide reach to not just their friends in school, but like teens all over the place. So if honing that power, that influence they have at 14, 15 years old, and they're like, oh, this thing just happened. This teenager was shot by police. Getting the word out there, informing people in ways that 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, wouldn't have been the case. Like, that's powerful. And when I hear a lot of older people talk about like, oh, these kids and their cell phones, it's like, this is the future. And like, if I had a cell phone when I was their age that had the type of capabilities that cell phones do now, like, I may have been farther along. Like, I look at my 14 and 15-year-olds, and I was like, I wasn't that aware of the world when I was that age. And they're sure. Just so aware, and they're so passionate, and they're even more, like, confident in themselves. And I feel like a lot of that comes from interacting not just with the people that are directly around them, but people from other places.
How difficult is it for you as a black woman? Granted, you have the opportunity to teach a lot of kids that do look like you. And I think that there's about half and half.
Yeah.
You know, so there is some power in that. But how do you manage to keep your sanity, and I wouldn't say your emotions in check, but at least be able to go home and not be broken down?
So the appropriate answer would be that I practice self-care, and I make sure that, like, when I'm at home, I leave work things at work, and I come home, and I rest, and I take care of myself.
What's the truth?
The truth is that I do not know what self-care is. These things are always on my mind. I don't know that I have an off switch. And while I see that it could be detrimental for burnout reasons, I can't relax. I think part of it is like, I think this is who I am. This is my purpose. And I just have to keep going in my purpose. There's a tweet that I made that's, it's like pinned on my Twitter.
Drop the handle first of all.
Oh, so my Twitter is Melanated Samus.
Sam, what? Melanated. Break it down. Break it down. Spell it and break it down, please.
M-E-L-A-N-A-T-E-D S-A-M-U-S. So melanated because I'm black.
Facts.
And Samus, one of my favorite video game characters, Samus Aran from the Metroid series of games. I love her a lot.
You're a bigger gamer than I am. I love it.
But yeah, so the tweet, and I have it pinned. It's it says, being patient while doing this equity work is not something I'm interested in doing. The violence of our systems doesn't take a break, so how can I not be impatient? This work is urgent, and I refuse to have patience in this time of emergency. So I think because this anti-racism work is so, it's urgent for me. Like, the violence of white supremacy doesn't take a break, so I feel like I can't take a break. I'm always doing things. I'm always volunteering to do things because, like, this is what keeps me going. This gives me purpose, and it is my purpose.
I'm glad you mentioned violence because we'll go in the obvious direction a little bit later with the recent news, but I feel like the word violence when it comes to white supremacy gets misused a lot because violence for most people means burning crosses, it means destroying property, yeah. It means either the injuring or the killing of people. But the violence of white supremacy can also be very, very soft. So from someone who can, I think, articulate this a little better than me, how do you describe the violence of white supremacy?
So in the world, violence is used in a very specific and limited way. So, like, as you mentioned, like, with cross burnings, with, like, lynchings, with, like, physically hurting people. But there's other ways to harm people, and any harm that is done is violence. So when my children are reading books in class from dead white men that take place in Europe that have nothing to do with anything that they can relate to, that's violence. They're not seeing themselves. When children feel ignored because of their skin color, that's violence. When a black child gets in more trouble for the same action that a white child does, that's violence. So anything that harms physically or emotionally, anything that makes someone feel less than, that's all violence. Like, a lot of what white supremacy does is not just, like, most racists aren't going around fighting and killing black people. A lot of them are. But a lot of the other people, a lot of the other racists that are doing harm, they are gaslighting black people. They are mentally abusing black people. They're verbally abusing black people. They are using all these, like, psychological tactics. And if we keep the definition of violence as just like, this person lynched this person shot this person, if we keep it to that, then that extends to the definition of racism, where people are like, oh, well, if he's not physically harming them, then he's not racist. Or if he doesn't actually say, I hate him because he's black, he's not racist. If we keep it to that, then that continues a cycle of gaslighting, because in microaggressions that are often covertly racist things, no one is saying, I did this to you because you are black. But if you define something as, if you define racism as, he has to say that I hate you because of your skin color, then you will constantly tell that black person, oh no, it wasn't because of that. And it invalidates all the other experiences of harm.
It's so interesting, though, that when it comes to racism, those who are being oppressed don't set the rules or the barometers. And that's kind of weird because not that I don't expect it. I mean, at this point, it's 2019. We pretty much know what it is. But it does kind of baffle me that it has to be. It baffles me that self-advocacy for racism is still happening and still so necessary and still enough to push somebody to the edge all at the same time.
Well, this system of white supremacy didn't come about slowly, and like, it's a system, so it's ingrained in every part of our society. So it's difficult, even if an individual realizes, if I said this thing to this black person, that may come off as, like, oh, perfect example. there was a day where I was in my classroom with my co-teacher. I had my hoodie on. I was, like, hiding in my hoodie. I was having a day. And one of our coworkers walked in, spoke to my, who was white, spoke to my co-teacher, who's white, and then, like, looked at me and, like, didn't recognize me for a second because I had my hood up. And he, like, said, he was like, oh, I didn't even realize it was you. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm under here. And then later on, when we were leaving the building, I ran into him again. And he was like, oh, I'm really sorry about what I said. I realized that I may have microaggressed you when I commented about your hoodie. And I hadn't seen it as something microaggressive-y. But he had the presence of mind to say, oh, I said something that may have come across as racist, and acknowledged it. So there are those individuals that do, but within the whole system, that's not the case. Because while he could say, me saying this small thing that wasn't, he didn't say anything about me being black or anything like that, but knew contextually that it could come off as racist, that's not something that is, that could be applied to the system. Because if it was, then the system would have to acknowledge not just overtly racist things, but covert racism.
Now, why is it so difficult to do this disarming in educational settings?
Because education in this country is white supremacist.
Break that down, please.
So, I mean, it's the way schools are, it started from factory work. It was like, we are putting you through the assembly line. Like, the whole first to kindergarten to 12th grade, how you move from grade to grade, that was modeled after the assembly line. Sitting in rows facing the teacher, being lectured at, all of those things, a part of white supremacy, because it also stems from there's one person here that is the authoritarian in the room, and they're the one that knows things. And you need to sit and listen because you don't know the things. So there's this invalidation of any experiences, any knowledge that the students have or come to the school with. And it's just teachers at the front of the classroom, they're teaching, you listen. It wasn't even until maybe, I don't know, the 1960s or so that, like, group work in classrooms were happening. Like, prior to that, you were sitting and staring at the teacher, and, like, there was no collaboration between students. So, like, even that was, like, radical. Like, oh, like, it's not the teacher lecturing, like, kids are just talking with each other about a question and exploring. They're not, like, being given the right answer. So all of that is white supremacy. One of the tenets of white supremacy is right. There's one right thing. This is what you must know. There's no divergent thinking. So in with that, when you have the people, the system stemming from that, and you have the people who are the teachers being white people who adhere to white supremacist doctrine, the things that you're learning, the history that you're learning, the literature that you're learning, the culture that you're learning is all going to be things that they've approved. So you think about, like, the boarding schools they sent Native Americans to. They sent them so they can learn white things, turn them from your culture is not good, you got to adhere to what we want. Even when they started integrating schools, like, they weren't integrating them and teaching black history and black culture. It was, you're integrated, you're in school with white kids, but you're still learning white history. You're still learning the things that we want you to learn. You're not learning about yourself. You're not seeing, we're not teaching the value of you. And like, that's how it's been.
That's well said. Somebody who is listening to this maybe for the first time, for many times, probably turned it off at this point because they felt some type of way about it.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
I don't care about the feelings of people that are racist.
But for those who are sort of gritting their teeth and going through this, I don't know if we can make this the official thing, but just the one time, the, hey, this is what this is, and here is why, so that nobody ever has to explain it again. When you equate the U.S. educational system with white supremacy doctrine, and someone says, but I'm not teaching white supremacy. I believe that everybody's equal. I believe that my students have a right to know how this country was founded. What do you say to them?
So, like, there's no equating white supremacy with the school system. Like, it is. Like, that was its foundation. Our country's foundation is white supremacists. We are founded on imperialism and genocide. So there's no way that anything that was founded out of that could be non-oppressive. So there's step one. Step two is, like, just look at most curriculums. They're teaching, especially in, like, I'm an English teacher, so that's what I look at a lot. A lot of the books are, you're reading Faulkner, and you're reading Nathaniel Hawthorne, and
reading Shakespeare.
Even. You're reading. I mean, I love me. I'm very biased.
But also,
So you're reading Shakespeare. There's this heavy emphasis on Shakespeare, which, like, on one hand, I understand. Like, he's contributed so much to our modern English language. But, like, so have a lot of other authors. But you're learning about all these old dead white men, a lot of them who were quite racist, but that side of them was not looked at. Because, like, oh, they've contributed so much great work. And then any people of color authors who they teach, it's all checkbox stuff. You're reading, like, you're reading Songs of Solomon by Toni Morrison. You're reading one Juno Diaz book. You're reading
Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston.
All these, like, checkbox things. And even when you're being taught books by people who look like you, you're still being taught them through this white gaze. It's not through the reading and the understanding of a black person or a native person or a woman, right? It's all through this white gaze. So Their Eyes Are Watching God, great book. I enjoyed it. It was probably one of the three books that I actually read from front to back in high school, like I was supposed to.
Oh, your teachers are mad.
But, like, it was great, but I was also being taught it by a white man and through, like, how he understood things, which, like, that's not to say there's not value in my English teacher. Who was it? Mesrel? I think it was Mesrel.
Yeah.
Senior? Yeah. Like, not to say that there was no value in his interpretation, but when you're constantly being taught everything through the white gaze, it's still engendering this white supremacist view. Because then it's like, hi, me, white person, am reading this book by a black woman, and I'm going to tell you what she means. I'm going to tell you what this cultural thing is. I'm going to tell you what I understand, and that's what it is. So even with those checkboxes, those little places where they throw in a person of color, they throw in a woman, it's still through the white gaze.
I'm sitting with that for a minute.
Yeah.
So for the record, don't ever say no one tried to explain it to you. Figure it out. Figure it out. Figure it out. If you stuck it out to this point, that means, yay, you either are a person of color or you actually have some intestinal fortitude.
You care about black people.
We touched on activism before. Sunday was not a good day. It was not a good day. That was the news with pretty much the whole country, whole world found out about the shooting death of musician, entrepreneur, rapper Nipsey Hussle. He was only 33 years old.
33.
The man died in front, to give you a picture of how sick the whole thing is. For those who are unaware, just a quick synopsis of who Nipsey Hussle was. Even if you took all the music away, which is actually quite good, he was Grammy nominated for his debut studio album. Even if you took all of that away, he was extremely involved in his community. What most people would say, hey, if you're from the hood and you make it out, this is what you need to do. He was all about it. The very store he was shot in front of that he owned, he bought because the owner at the time said, all these little kids from the hood, I don't want them in here. So we turned around and bought the property. He was forward thinking. He wanted the community involved in STEM. He wanted kids to learn how to code. He was not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, and we will touch on that a little bit later when it comes to reflection and things like that. But even if you didn't know who he was before Sunday happened, after you did, you felt a loss. I know that that was true for me.
Yeah, I think it was wild because I learned about Nipsey back when he was, I don't remember what year it was, but he was in Double XL's freshman issue from like way back. And I was like, oh, okay, his music is cool. This is interesting. And then I didn't really like keep up with his music. I'm very weird with music. I like listen to something new and then just fall back into like old stuff that I was listening to and like listen to it for like ever. Forever. I just get into mood. So I hadn't listened to Nipsey in like a few years. And then 2 weeks ago, one of my Spotify, like the daily mixes that they make for you, one of his songs from his new album came on and I was like, oh, I forgot that I liked Nipsey. Okay. And listened to it for a little bit. I hadn't touched his album yet. And then Friday, there's a new tech guy at my school. And I went and I was like sharing music with him because I know he's a producer. And he's into music, so I was like, have you listened to the last Styles P album? Because I love me some Styles P.
Come on.
So I was like, he was like, no, what was it? I was like, it's called Dimebag. Get on Spotify right now. It's very good. No features, and it's so good. So good.
Sounds like another rapper so we good. All know.
So, like, shared that with him, and then I don't know how it came up, but he asked me about if I had heard Victory Lap. His music was playing low, and like I heard a snippet of the Nipsey song that had come up on my Spotify list, and I was like, "Oh, that's Nipsey."
Do you remember what song it was? Because it was from the new album, yeah.
It is from the new album, All My Life.
Okay.
Yes, because it has like an upbeat beat.
Unbelievable.
And I was like, oh, that's Nipsey. And he was like, yeah. He was like, have you heard his last album? And I was like, no, I didn't. I didn't realize. I like didn't keep up with him. So he started playing it while we were talking. And I was like, oh, this is good. I was like, this is music that I'm going to listen to on my way home. And I did listen to it Friday on my way home. By the time I got home, had gone through the whole album. And I texted my friend who he shares music with me all the time. I was like, I forgot how much I love Nipsey. And I was like, this album is really good. And I really enjoyed it. And then Saturday, I listened to it too. And then Sunday, I was just relaxing. And I like scrolled past a news article that said he'd been shot. And I was like, oh, but it was like he was shot, like, wound, and he was like, Nipsey shot and two others wounded. So I was like, okay, he's wounded. I was like, he'll make it through, like, it'll be fine. And then, like, the next article was, like, confirmed dead. And I was like, this is wild. Because, like, I was just talking about the man. Right. I'd just gotten back right. into his music. And about a half an hour later, my friend who I'd spoken to on Friday hit me up and he was like, Liv, this is wild. And I was like, yeah. So yeah, it felt like a loss. And I think, like, I hadn't, like, as I said, I hadn't kept up with a lot of his music and with him, but I knew about, like, things that he was doing in the community. And it was like, this is not just a loss for people who, like, listen to his music, but this is a loss for the community that had been impacted by the good that he'd been doing. And then was like, they killing the wrong people. But that's neither here or there.
Oh, boy.
But yeah, it was like, it's not just a loss for music. Like, he's helped so many people in his community. Yeah, and it was over a beef.
That was the thing that just had me like, wow. Because you already know about 2-3 hours after he was reported to have passed away, immediately it's like, oh, well, the update says it was probably gang related. It was.
Oh, no. On my feed, it was like, oh, he was making a Dr. Sebi documentary. So the government, it was all these conspiracy theories. All these conspiracy theories.
It's so weird because it's not out of the, just putting on my tinfoil hat for 5 seconds, it's not out of the realm of possibility that the government was involved in silencing somebody.
Of course.
Do not. I think it was over him?
No. Like,
I don't.
Like, so many, like, information about Dr. Sebi is out there. Like, Nipsey wasn't some, like, deep cover agent that would have, in the documentary, would have put some, like, new information, right?
We don't but know also, that, but well, you never know.
But also, like, Dr. Sebi, like, there was a meme where it was like he cured stage 4 pancreatic cancer by having people rub guacamole on their chest.
You gotta go. You gotta go.
But like, so aside from that, it's like it doesn't connect because if anything, like there are other people that like supported Dr. Sebi and was like wanting to give information about him, like. But also, like, all my man said was, like, eat this way and drink this way and blah, 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 blah. Like, the government's not killing you for that. And I remember, like, as I saw those start coming in about those conspiracy theories, I was like, y'all are really finna reduce this man's legacy to killed because of a Dr. Sebi documentary when he's done all this. Like, you could be like, the government killed him because he was making a change in the community. Like, you could have said that. But you whittled it down to this Dr. Sebi documentary. And I was like, that is so dismissive and disrespectful and invalidating. Because, like, the government has killed people for trying to make change in their community.
Or at least has been reported, not reported, but at least there has been written evidence to they're tracking down.
Yeah, so like, I mean, let's not even get into all the activists that have been
Coming up missing all of a
dead,
sudden.
Right? But like, so like, that could have been your theory, but you focused on this documentary that like,
come on, bro.
So, yeah.
I think when you look at somebody like Nipsey, I'm really glad I'm in the group chat that I'm in with my friends, Blake, Jeff, Clay, Kevin. I expect you all to have clicked play on this. We sort of broke down just how social media has sort of changed our world when it comes to, I would say, maybe hot takes after somebody passes away.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, just their takeaway on their legacy or on their life. And one thing that was put in the chat was, are we really going to reduce, in your frame of speaking, are we really going to reduce this man's entire legacy to comments that he made or mistakes that he made. And there was a point brought up in response that said, well, if the words he said affected that community and he never really addressed it, people have the right to maybe not be disrespectful, but maybe not mourn him as the whole glorified in the glorified obituary
of
sense.
Of course. Like,
and to go into what he said, this was for one of the events he held last year, January. He made some very disparaging remarks about the LGBT community, particularly the Black LGBT community, saying that, and I quote, this is from his IG caption. The post is no longer there, but here's what he said. Demonstration speaks louder than conversation. They gonna feed us every image of our men and boys, but this one. No hyperviolent, no homosexual, no abandoners, just strong Black men and young men. Respect to my big homie for leading with love and intelligence. God is with us. Who can go against us? And obviously, there was way more than that, but it's really weird to figure out how one feels about this while being respectful. And then the question becomes, well, how respectful is respectful, or is respect even accounted for?
Like, it's what just, is respect?
Yeah, like it turned into this whole philosophical debate because I saw one person say, you don't have to mourn anybody that never regarded your humanity in the first place. And then there was one that says, we're really going to reduce comments that he made out of everything he did. It was just, it was so much back and forth on
so
this.
So I think... So I only learned, like, so as I said, like, I hadn't been up on anything he's done until, like, 2 weeks ago. But, like, I saw that comment, and I was like, that's wild. I didn't know he said that. But it made sense, because if you, like, chances are, if you are someone who has an affinity for Dr. Sebi and his beliefs and follow and words, you are at least Hotep adjacent, at most boy. A Hotep. So that didn't surprise me at all. Like, putting those pieces together, that didn't surprise me. I will say that anyone who, like, those remarks are... a part of those remarks are violent.
Yes, they are.
Right?
They are.
So, while he didn't actively or physically do anything to homosexuals, or specifically homosexual Black men, which was the
intent.
The intent of the post, that mindset is being bolstered by his words. And if I was a homosexual Black man and I hear that, I'm allowed to be like, I'm not messing with him because he has denied my humanity, right? So for people to be like, oh, you like whittling down his legacy to just these words, like those words were a part of him. And if he has disregarded my humanity, I don't have to mourn him. Like, we don't have to mourn anybody, right? And choosing not to mourn someone, choosing not to be sad that someone died when that person hasn't respected you as a human being, that's not disrespectful. Like,
that's almost practicing a form of self-care.
That's self-care. Like, I don't have to care that you died. Like, you dying doesn't have to affect me.
That's true.
And the only
caveat?
Not really caveat, but the only conversation or conflict that would ever come up in a conversation like this would be if, like, someone is celebrating the death of that person. Like, that is something that is controversial. Like, is it okay to celebrate if someone died? Like, that is a conversation that you can go back and forth with. But if someone is like, I don't care that he died because he didn't see me as human, that person has the right to feel that way. And that, there's nothing disrespectful about that.
That's fair. And let me, even though I don't love that that is a factor, I respect that that's where they're coming from. But let me say this. Speaking as a straight Black man, we got to do better. We flat out have to do better. You can blame it on your faith. You can blame it on your upbringing. You can blame it on your background. But the sheer fact of the matter is that it's one thing to be a member of the LGBTQIA community. It's another thing to be a member of that community and black. You get it both ways, and both sides are telling you not right now. That's a sentiment I've seen put everywhere. It's a sentiment that I've seen places, but if I can at least lend a voice to it, like, we have to do better, and we have to knock it off, because what you are then doing is you are telling somebody that they are not fit to be around your what you consider quote-unquote good because you can't respect the way that they live.
No, you are denying their humanity. Like, you are saying that they should not exist.
Right.
And there's no
place for that at all. There's none.
It doesn't matter what your back, like, people bring up like their Christian beliefs as the reason, and like, as Christians, we're supposed to follow the teachings and the examples of Christ, and Christ interacted with love and with respect with people that did not follow his religion. Also, Christ was Jewish, remember that, right?
Oh boy.
Did not follow his religion. He interacted with them with respect and treated them with dignity, right? Even when his disciples went out and like were preaching and people weren't listening, Christ was like, okay, like, that's fine, just keep preaching. Like, you don't have to be pressed about it, right? But like, everything he did and everything he said was with respect and with love. And when people use Christ, use Christianity as a purpose or an excuse to hate, you are saying that you actually don't really believe what Christ said and did.
The interesting thing, I'm actually really glad we went on that tangent, because I don't understand how, and this will tie this whole episode up in a really big, there are no sports being talked about in this episode, bow.
I mean, we could talk about football and Colin Kaepernick.
Oh, I've touched that too many times.
Because activism, but yes.
Yeah, but trust me, this can be a sports-free episode, I promise, because I think to bring the whole thing on home, the biggest problem with 2019 in this day and age is that we are seeing the living embodiment, if you're a scholar, open your Bibles, of 1 Samuel 8. In 1 Samuel 8, for those who are unfamiliar, let me explain to you what happened. The people were ruled by God and by a prophet. The people came to the prophet Samuel one day and said, "You ain't good enough. We want a king. We want to be just like everybody else." Are you fact-checking my book?
No, I believe you.
No, I'm going to fact-check my book. Because I will not have anybody from my church or from any walk of my life saying, "Oh, wow, you really did."
Is this
really
where, like, they asked because, like, they wanted to be like the other nations?
That's exactly it,
yeah,
yes.
They wanted to be like the other nations. They're like, "We want a king. We don't want this religious ruler." And then the king they got didn't work out for them.
Exactly. Oof. And let me tell you something. Let's get there. It is, yes, it is 1 Samuel 8, verses 4 and 5. We want to be just like everybody else. And the biggest problem I have with that, when you look at the way that Christianity is even viewed in this country, it's less about Christ and it's way more about using the book of the Bible to govern the law of the land.
You want me to tell you why?
Oh, I was going to get there, but you smarter, go.
White supremacy.
Yes.
It's the imperialism. Like they left Europe for religious freedom, quote unquote, right? The Protestants came over, but they came with their belief of like, oh, religious freedom, but like Christianity the way I want it to be.
Exactly.
Not we are gonna respect the religions of other people. So they have they came with the idea that religious freedom is just their type of Christianity, right? Because Protestantism they were being persecuted by like the Catholics and whatnot, right? So they come over and they're like, oh yes, we'll do this, right? But because of that, they've spread that their form of Christianity. So it's still that white supremacist tenet of like, what's right is right, right? So this is how I interpret the Bible. This is how I interpret these words. This is what it's going to be.
And to bring it all back biblical, because hashtag context, when you look at the way that Samuel said, okay, you want what you want? All right, fine. That's great. I feel like a lot of people in the church were in love with the idea of being governed by the Bible without quite understanding that the people who are using the Bible don't read the book.
They cherry pick things.
They cherry pick what fits their agenda and they run away with it. Is there any other way to explain why a bunch of the white evangelical leaders in America backed a man who can't even say 2 Corinthians?
That man has never
Are you kidding me? And then you have the audacity to either have buyer's remorse or still call him God's chosen one. And I'm like, are you, what?
Yes.
Like,
it's,
what?
It's cognitive dissonance. It's the blindness that whiteness, the disease of whiteness gives. And so it's like, this is just confirming what I want. There are people that voted for him strictly because of his anti-abortion stance, his quote-unquote religious freedom stance, and they cherry-pick these things, and they're like, okay, well, this is what I believe. He said two of the things I believe. Even though he's spewing hatred, and I'm supposed to love my neighbor, as Jesus said, I'm just going to go with him because he's against abortion. And I don't want that. Even though that may not affect my life, or actually it does not affect my life, but I'm going to still go with that because I want to control what other people are doing with their own bodies.
And then when you tie in the fact that they were okay with him being like racist to just about everybody else. Like, yes, this happened 3 years ago. 2020 is supposedly coming. I don't really count. I've been saying this world is not my home since November 9th, 2016, but it is what it is. Like, I cannot ever, ever, ever deal with the idea that this is quote unquote a Christian nation because it was never a Christian nation.
Thomas Jefferson ripped out pages of the Bible that he didn't agree with. Like, this has never been a Christian nation.
And they
need to stop because, No.
And if we're going to be absolutely full polyscience here, you cannot be a democracy and then use the Bible as law.
Nope.
You can't. Because then you're a theocracy, which this nation is very fond of saying that it is not.
Yeah.
So when you end up having a representative, when they're swearing in the first ever Muslim representative in Pennsylvania, this representative stops and say, God, turn the hearts of the nation back to you. And it wasn't an earnest prayer either.
That woman did not sound like she prays regularly.
Boy!
Like I made a post, right? So as Christians, we're supposed, like, prayer is seen as bolstering our relationship with Christ, and prayer is our conversation with Christ, right? We're talking, right? And that's something you do often. And when you speak to someone often, there's like, you speak with them with more comfort, right? You can tell the difference between someone speaking with someone who they are very familiar with and someone who they just met. There's a difference, right?
Ooh.
That woman did not sound like she knew Christ. She sounded like she was praying to a stranger. Like, that prayer, like, even within her hatred and her Islamophobia, like, it did not sound like the prayer of someone who prays regularly. So, and that, it only goes, and that's exhibit number 900 and million whatever, of people that only pull out Christ when they want to hate others.
Oof.
And that's what our country does.
Say that.
That is what our country does.
And the sad part about it is, now you have, the witness is shot at that point. The witness is in shambles. You're supposed to go and make disciples. So he says, no one's going to want to follow that. Nobody. Because all anybody will say is, oh, see, that's your Christian doctrine, right? Keeping in mind, ooh, we're going to run out of time slightly. But I'm so glad that you touched on the Bible and the relation to white supremacy, because the very same people saying, oh, Christianity is the white man's religion, sometimes forget the fact that the slave owners, when they had slaves, ripped out pages of the Bible that said, rather they emphasized the verses that said slave or free, mm-hmm. and created a false doctrine, mm-hmm. in which freedom was not guaranteed for a slave.
Yes, let's also keep in mind that Christianity was in Africa before imperialism.
Thank you.
So that was a thing. It wasn't in all parts, but it was there, right? And also keeping in mind that when you constantly say that Christianity is the white man's religion, Jesus was not a white man.
The book said, and I quote, skin of bronze.
He was brown.
But when
you say things like that, you take away people's agency. You whittle them down to someone who is just a sheep that's just following, someone that can't make decisions on their own. There are people that, like, as much as it's like, yes, this is the history of this religion with my people, I've had experiences within this religion that other things can't explain, or I feel a connection to this, right? So when you just constantly say, like, oh, you're only with it because, like, it was forced on your people, like, that may be the case for some people, but you can't ignore the fact that people have made a conscious choice to follow this religion, to follow Christ, to have a relationship with Christ,
right.
And constantly just bringing it back to, it's the white man's religion. Like, it also ignores spirituality. Like, different people find spirituality in different ways. And who are you to invalidate where they found their spirituality?
Because the two people in the same service, one will love the music and the other will be like, the music was cool, but I was here for the word.
Mm-hmm.
That's different. When you break down spirituality within the church context, even in that way, people get scared, but they shouldn't be. They really shouldn't be. It's about embracing who you are.
Yeah.
And because the truth is, God did not create us all to be the same.
We don't all connect the same way. We have different gifts.
Twerks.
We connect different things. Like me, praise songs, upbeat songs, they're cool, they're nice. That's not where I connect. Some worship music, that's where I'm at.
I'm with you
right?
on that one.
With certain types of, like, preaching, where they're, like, super high energy, that's not for me. But when they're sitting and they're talking and they're expounding, like, that, like, and not everyone connects that way.
Right.
And, like, people have to realize everything isn't for everyone, and it's important to find what you click with, because when you find what you click with, that will help you grow and learn.
And for me, if we're going to wrap this up, actually, we'll put the cherry on top of this little bow. I do love my worship songs. I love my praise songs. But if you give me a groove, that's it. You give me a good turn, that's it. I can go home. My spirit was fed off of that, but that might just be the musician.
But yeah, you're a musician.
Yeah.
I'm a singer.
Put the quotes down. Stop playing with these people.
I'm a singer. See, I can't sing. That didn't sound very good.
You didn't even try. Don't make me mess around and produce your EP. Look, tell the people. tell the people where they can find you, what you're up to next, everything, please, because I personally really enjoyed this.
Gotcha. So, as I said before, on Twitter, I'm Melanated Samus, MelanatedSamus, right? It'll say Live the Teaching Activist, because I'm a teaching activist. On Facebook, I'm Liv Roach. On Instagram, I am Melanated Cold Brew, like cold brew coffee, because I love it.
I'm surprised you went with coffee. Is that the only... No, it's Nitro Brew. Sorry. We were on a holy note, not just a ramble.
So, yeah, so that's where you can find me on the interwebs. The next thing I'm doing in 2 weeks, I'm going to be helping to facilitate a workshop at Hunter about navigating incidents around race in schools. I work with Hunter a lot. I'm a part of their equity and advocacy committee. So a lot of the workshops that they do around anti-racism, I'm a part of that. Yes.
Thank you, Liv, the teaching activist. Thank you.
Of course.
Once again, this has been an episode of In My Bag with Nkwa Sonye. Thank you for joining us. You can find the show on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, and on Anchor. Feel free to follow me on Twitter, @_ASONYE, on the Instagram, @sometimesjr. We'll see you in 2 weeks. If you love it, rate it 5 stars. Leave a message in the Anchor app. Love to hear some feedback, because if you sat through this whole thing, I'm pretty sure you have thoughts. You might as well let me hear them. Yeah. See you in 2 weeks. Peace and blessings.
Can I say one last thing?
Sure.
Yep.
New York, we at you! Later, folks.